rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, and CRN Digital, and cable systems in 29 states. Thanks to CRN Digital for carrying our signal as well. If you don't like what the mother of a fallen soldier has to say, what do you do? How about smearing her? Smearing her. Can you believe it? Last night on Fox's O'Reilly Factor, O'Reilly and right-wing... what would you call this woman? Columnist? Pundit? I'm sure that you probably have better words. And I can think of a few. But anyhow, they decided to just slime Cindy Sheehan. Just to, you know, just go after her. Say, you know, here's O'Reilly saying that Cindy Sheehan is guilty of treason. If you can just even imagine that.
I mean, I think Mrs. Sheehan bears some responsibility for this, and also for the responsibility of other American families who have lost sons and daughters in Iraq who feel that this kind of behavior borders on treasonous.
On treasonous. Saying, Mr. President, I would like to know why my son died. What was the noble cause for which he died? Please explain to me. We all understand that you were telling us that there was this nuclear bomb going to come.
The evidence indicates that Iraq is reconstituting its nuclear weapons program. Saddam Hussein has held numerous meetings with Iraqi nuclear scientists, a group he calls his nuclear mujahideen, his nuclear holy warriors, facing clear evidence of peril. We cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Yeah, but we now know that Bush knew at the time that he said that he was lying. Just plain old flat-out lying. We've read the Downing Street memo. We've read the Downing Street minutes. We've heard from Paul O'Neill, the former Secretary of Treasury. We've heard from Richard Clark in sworn testimony before Congress. We know George Bush was lying. We've heard from his biographer, who in 1999, back even before he was running for president, said if he became president, he would attack Iraq because he knew it would gain him political capital. It would let the Republicans take back the House and Senate. That's what this was all about. This is a war for politics, for power. George Bush told his biographer that, therefore, he would not have a failed presidency like his father. In other words, he'd get reelected if he had a chance to invade Iraq. And he did. So anyhow, last night we've got O'Reilly talking about Cindy Sheehan being guilty of treason. Now, this, of course, is not the first time that O'Reilly has used the treason word in reference to anybody who dares to undermine George Bush's assertions that he himself should have the power to simply declare war on a country because, well, you just have to trust him, right? We just have to take what George says for a fact. There can't be any kind of global test. We shouldn't have to prove to anybody that there's actually a risk, right? If we're going to lie our way into a war, we should be able to lie our way into a war. And anybody who challenges that, they're undermining the president. And undermining the president, well, that's a terrible thing.
Because you must know the difference between dissent from the Iraq war and the war on terror, and undermining it. And any American that undermines that war with our soldiers in the field.
And then, of course, O'Reilly will do what the Bushies always do. They try to tie 9/11 in to Iraq, even though 9/11 had nothing to do with Iraq. In fact, George W. Bush himself even once said there's no connection.
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
Yeah. We have no evidence. Anyhow, Bill O'Reilly, of course, obligatorily has to try and tie 9/11 into this.
Or undermines the war on terror with 3,000 dead on 9/11 is a traitor.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Everybody got it? Dissent? Fine. Undermining? You're a traitor.
You don't undermine that president, you liberals.
Right. So,
all those clowns over at the liberal radio network. We could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains? Because they, you know, they're undermining everything.
Yeah, so here's O'Reilly, you know, with the traitor word, the treason word, throwing these things out. And then him and Michelle Malkin sitting around talking about Cindy Sheehan, a woman who lost her son so that George Bush could, so that the Republican Party could take back the Senate from, you know, after Jim Jeffords left the Republicans lost the Senate in 2001. And so that, who lost her son, so that Bush and the Republicans could take back the Senate, hold on to the House, and Bush could get himself elected in 2004. And Michelle Malkin, this absolute weasel, Michelle Malkin and Bill O'Reilly, well, I don't know that she's a weasel. Actually, you know, my daughter had a couple of ferrets once, and which are weasels, and they were fairly nice. I'm not sure that I would go so far as to compliment Michelle Malkin by calling her a weasel. In any case, whatever she is, I'll let you come up with your own epithet. She's talking with Bill O'Reilly last night, and she's reading the mind of Cindy Sheehan.
I can't imagine that Casey Sheehan would approve...
Excuse me. She's reading the mind of Cindy Sheehan's son, Casey, who is now dead 16 months. And O'Reilly doesn't even realize that Casey's a man, by the way. And so here we are again.
I can't imagine that Casey Sheehan would approve of such behavior,
well,
conduct.
Well, I have to
rhetoric.
Say that she obviously does.
Yeah, right, right. So Michelle Malkin has had her say. Cindy Sheehan, this morning, issued a statement in response to Michelle Malkin and Bill O'Reilly. These pathetic pontificators sitting around trashing a woman whose son died in an illegal, immoral war, accusing her of treason, calling her a traitor, and saying that her son would not agree with what she's doing. Cindy Sheehan spoke out.
I didn't even know Casey knew Michelle Malkin, you know, and I'm Casey's mother. I know him better than anybody else in the world, and I know Casey is up there, and Casey's saying, "You go, Mom," and he is just like saying, I can hear him going, George Bush did not know what he was going to unleash when he did this to me, you know, and I can't bring Casey back, and I wonder how often Michelle Malkin has sobbed on my son's grave. You know, did she come to his funeral? Did she sit up with him when he was sick, when he was a baby? You know, that to me, that is the most despicable thing. I can speak for my son, and I feel like it was a miracle that I got well yesterday. But, you know, I've been doing this for months, and I never get sick. I have the energy of 100 people, and I believe it's Casey and the rest of the people who have been killed so unjustly and so needlessly in this war. They're holding me up. I will never give up. I promise you that.
She will never give up, says Cindy Sheehan, her statement in response to Bill O'Reilly and Michelle Malkin trashing her. Trashing her. I mean, how sick does this get? Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. TomHartman.com, the website, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Joshua in Chicago, thoughts on this issue. Hey, Joshua, welcome to the program. What's on your mind,
man? Oh, thanks, Tom. I just wanted to say how proud I am of Cindy Sheehan and her starting Gold Star. I saw her on C-SPAN when Representative Conyers had to go in the basement and they were talking about the Downing Street minutes, and she seemed like such a brave woman then. And now she goes, I mean, she's doing what I think my mom would do for me if God forbid it was in such a situation. She would look for answers and be dogged, grab onto the throat and not stop until something gets done.
Yeah, it's amazing. We've got a media that, first of all, thank you, Joshua. I absolutely agree with you and it's well said. We have a media that lionizes the mother of a daughter who is missing down in Aruba. Makes her into a national hero. You know, a missing cute white girl's mom. Ignore the fact that there's several women missing in other parts of the Caribbean who are women of color, have been missing even longer, you know, and that's a whole other rant, right? But nonetheless, we have a media that lionizes this, says, isn't it wonderful, this mother fighting to find out who is the person who killed her daughter? Who is responsible? Who made the decision that led to the death of her daughter? Who decided to kill her daughter? And then you've got a woman who is saying, quite simply, who killed my son? Who made the decision to kill my son? Why was that decision made? Simply tell me, please. What is the noble cause for which Casey Sheehan died? Please, George, what is the noble cause for which he died? And if that cause is so noble, why are your two unemployed daughters not joining the military? Can you please just, you know, let us know? We'd appreciate it. And the Bush administration's response, of course, they're going to have a fundraiser tonight. And today, this morning, was supposed to be the day. It was going to be one of those Herbert Hoover moments. And I think the Bush administration suddenly realized it was going to be a Herbert Hoover moment, and that's why they stopped. But they were going to the Hoovervilles, or these camps. The bonus army, this is after World War I, and during the Great Depression, 1930, 1931, early 1932, you had people camp out, homeless people camping out along the banks of the Potomac, saying, we'd like our bonus from World War I, the soldiers, and then, you know, people living, you know, homeless people in New York City, in Central Park, living in shacks. They called them Hoovervilles. In fact, people would walk around with a pocket pulled inside out and hanging outside their pants, you know, the pants pocket. And those were called Hoover flags as a way of saying, you know, hey, I'm penniless. I'm broke. I don't have a job. And so what does Herbert Hoover do? He has his generals, Douglas MacArthur and Dwight Eisenhower, ride their horses into the Hoovervilles and set them on fire and drive the people out. Big mistake. Big mistake. And Franklin Roosevelt beat him in the election of 1932, you know, just effortlessly. And George Bush nearly did the same thing. We had heard that today, because Condi Rice and Don Rumsfeld are arriving, and they're going to have to drive by Cindy Sheehan. And tonight, they're having a party for the Rangers and the Pioneers and the Super Pioneers, the people who gave $100,000, $200,000, or $350,000 and more to George W. Bush. There's a word for that when women do it on the street, but in any case, or men for that matter. All these folks, all these Johns who are going to show up, and they're going to have to drive by Cindy. And so the Bush administration decided that as of today, they were going to declare Cindy Sheehan a threat to national security. They appear to have changed their mind on that now. But, you know, we'll see. Now, instead, what we've got is a right-wing radio talk show host organizing a rally against Cindy down there. And all night long, you got local right-wingers driving by honking their horns, harassing her. Yeah. 20 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
My fellow Americans, check it. As your president, I've been real busy, so I thought I'd take a minute to let y'all know what I've been up to. For starters, I turned the strongest economy in history into the biggest deficit in history and lost over 2.5 million jobs. My good friend, Ken Lay, was in charge of that whole Enron thing. I invaded two countries, made a joke of the United Nations, broke the Geneva Conventions, and I still managed to take more vacation than any other president. So, to summarize, terrorist, 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 9/11, 9/11, and God bless America. Thank you.
You gave them the old razzle-dazzle. You razzle-dazzled them.
Oh, George, you did so good.
You gave them an act with lots of flash in it. Made them believe you were compassionate.
Except for that lady Cindy. She's not sure she believes it.
Hocus, yeah, misdirected them.
In fact, she's thinking that maybe you lied to her.
9/11 and Saddam Hussein. You played them both right to perfection, despite the fact there's no
connection. You razzle-dazzle them, let those blue states complain.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Yeah, thank you. Welcome back. Yes, just so long as I'm the dictator. Boy, that's the most sinister laugh. It's creepy, you know. It's creepy. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. By the way, as we go through the day here, in the second hour of our program, we're going to be talking about Justice Sunday. God save these corrupt Republicans. And some interesting profiles of some of the folks who are going to be participating in Justice Sunday. I think you'll find interesting. And Ohio election activists say the voters are fed up. So are we. Let's take our country back. In the third hour of our program, we're going to have our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment we usually do on Thursdays. This one is going to be, is your computer spying on you? Are your moves on the Internet being followed without your permission? That and the gates of hell open for both Americans and Iraqis. And why won't Scooter Libby grant Judith Miller a personal waiver? Why doesn't Scooter Libby want to allow Judith Miller to testify the way that Karl Rove allowed Matt Cooper to testify from Time magazine? Interesting question, interesting answers. Congress of the United States, August 10, 2005, to the President, the White House, Washington, D.C. Dear Mr. President, we write to respectfully urge you to meet with Cindy Sheehan and other relatives of fallen soldiers who request a meeting to discuss their deep concerns about the war in Iraq. We also request that you help ensure that Ms. Sheehan and her colleagues are not arrested as long as they continue to wait for a meeting with you at their location in a peaceable and legal manner that they have maintained thus far. So, and the letter goes on, you know, since the loss of her son, Ms. Sheehan and other families have been committed to helping family members of other soldiers who've been lost in Iraq. Ms. Sheehan, in fact, founded Gold Star Families for Peace, a support organization for families of fallen soldiers. So for several days now, she's been waiting outside your ranch. See, even, they're so nice, these members of Congress, these 38 members of Congress who signed this letter. They call it a ranch. I call it a hobby ranch, a hobby farm. I mean, he's afraid of horses, so it's not really a ranch, because you ride horses on ranches, and George W. Bush is afraid of horses. And it never really was a ranch when he bought it in 2000 when he was running for president and thought it would look Reagan-esque to have a ranch. It was a pig farm. So, but anyhow, they call it a ranch, not a pig farm or a farm, so... or a hobby farm. Hoping to meet with you about the loss of her son and the failure to discover weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, Ms. Sheehan has indicated that she is planning to continue her vigil for the entirety of your vacation at your Crawford complex, if necessary. And they go on, you know, please, given the recent tragic loss of American lives and many deaths, we hope that you can appreciate why family members believe it's so important that they exercise their rights as citizens to petition their government. Gee, just that First Amendment thing, you know? Signed by John Conyers, George Miller, Maxine Waters, Corrine Brown, Dennis Kucinich, Carolyn Maloney, Bob Filner, Mike Honda, Raul Grijalva, Jan Schakowsky, Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick, Frank Pallone, Gwen Moore, John Oliver, Pete Stark, Sam Farr, Julia Carson, Sheila Lee Jackson, Diane Watson, Major Owens, Xavier Becerra, Jim McGovern, Jim McDermott, Barbara Lee, Lynn Woolsey, Lloyd Doggett, Betty McCollum, Danny Davis, Zoe Lofgren, James Oberstar, Gerald Nadler, Henry Waxman, Peter DeFazio, Elijah Cummings, Hilda Solis, John Lewis, and Bernie Sanders. And maybe that's why George isn't arresting Cindy today. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We've got lines by the trush. We're the billionaires for Bush. We're determined to keep it that way. Though there's money to burn, we expect things in return. And we get what we want when we
pay. Yeah, the billionaires from Bush assembling in Crawford, Texas today. Yes, indeed. Yesterday, or was it the day before yesterday, we had a conversation with Cindy Sheehan here on this program, And she addressed one of the major charges that is being put against her by the right, which is that she did have a meeting with George W. Bush 2 months after her son died. And, you know, why didn't she raise her concerns with him then? And I think that's a legitimate question. And Cindy had an answer for that. I'll just share with you my interview with her day before yesterday, where she addressed that specifically, that issue, along with a few others. We have Cindy Sheehan with us. I want to hop right over to her. Mark, thank you very much for the call. Cindy is one of the founders of Gold Star Mothers for Peace. Is that right, Cindy?
Gold Star Families for Peace.
Gold Star Families for Peace. Thank you for correcting me. And you have been on our program before. I think with what you are doing is extraordinary. You lost your son, Casey, in Iraq. It's been about a year now, hasn't it?
It's been 16 months.
16 months. And
Now she's in Texas, camped outside the ranch.
That's right. You are generating some headlines because you want to speak with George W. Bush. If you had an opportunity to speak with George W. Bush, what would you say to him?
I want to know what the noble causes my son has died for. You know, and you guys know and your listeners know that since April of 2004, the Downing Street memos have surfaced, the Dulfer report, the 9/11 Commission report, and the Senate Intelligence report that just proved categorically without a doubt that this war was based on lies. And my son shouldn't be dead. The 1,100 other children shouldn't be dead. Tens of thousands of innocent Iraqis should not be dead. And we're still allowing the carnage to continue. So I want to know, what is this noble cause? And number two, I want him to quit using my son's sacrifice to justify the continued killing. He keeps saying we have to honor the sacrifices of the fallen heroes.
By killing more.
Pardon me?
We have to honor those who are dead by killing more.
Right, right. And I'm like, I'm a mother. I had my heart ripped out and my soul ripped out on April 4th, 2004. Why would I want one more mother, American or Iraqi, to go through this? And Tom, I did meet with George Bush in June of 2004. And
what was that experience like?
It was terrible. And the right-wing media is using this against me because they think that, you know, something that happened in June of 2004 before all these reports came out and when my son had only been dead 2.5 months and I was in a deep state of shock and grief, they think that that has something to do with August of 2005 because the president told us at this meeting, I asked him, I said, what are we doing here? Why did we get invited? We did not vote for you in 2000. We're not going to vote for you in 2004. We've been lifelong Democrats. And he told me, Mom, this is not about politics. So after the meeting, my husband and I decided that we would not talk about the meeting in a negative light because we believed George W. Bush for some reason. I don't even know why we believed him. And so I did not talk negatively about it until August at the RNC when he said, I meet with the families. It was totally about politics because he doesn't go to their funerals.
Right.
You know, he was using our meeting for political gain, saying that, you know, we say we're all praying for him and we say that we don't want our loved ones' deaths to be in vain. You know what? I don't want Casey to die in vain. I want Casey's death to stand for bringing our troops home. That's how he can honor my son's death. And so now the right-wing media is saying, you know, well, you didn't talk badly about him when you had the chance right after you met him. You know, and so that what they're doing is they're putting up a smoke screen. They're trying to get the attention off the immorality and illegality of this war and of all the death and destruction he's caused by putting it on a grieving mother.
That's the bottom line right there. That's the bottom line. And Cindy Sheehan points out that at the time that she met with George W. Bush, the Dulfer report hadn't come out. They were still expecting to find weapons of mass destruction. The Downing Street memos and Downing Street minutes had not come out. We didn't realize that this was not just a lie, but an intentional, well-choreographed, carefully rehearsed, well-done lie. We hadn't realized that. There was just so much that wasn't known. And that George had said, Mom, this isn't about politics, and she believed him. She took him at his word that it wasn't about politics. And, you know, which clearly was a mistake, shall we say, at the very least. And so that's in answer to that question. I know some folks are asking that question. I think it's a legitimate question, and Cindy Sheehan has answered it. And has answered it well, and I think it's important that her words be on the record for that. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to call in. TomHartmann.com, of course, the website, if you want to drop into our live chat room. KJ in Camas, Washington on the line. Hey, KJ, what's up?
Yeah, two quick things. To Cindy, you are up there with Patrick Henry, Tom Paine, and Tom Jefferson. Rock on. My other comment is about Michelle Malkin. We get her in the paper here in Vancouver every Friday. Always raving about liberals, and I think that's interesting considering that, you know, she is an Asian woman. Now, it was liberals that rescinded the laws that prevented Asians from holding U.S. citizenship, and it is liberalism that makes it possible for her as a woman to pursue a career in journalism. You know, before, I mean, were it for liberals, what would she? She'd be what, a wife and a mommy?
Yeah, well,
maybe.
You know, nobody's ever accused Michelle Malkin of being A, consistent, or B, ethical. So, you know, well said, KJ. 1-866-889-8894, Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hello, Tom Hartman.
Hey, Gary.
To the shameful, just my opinion, one man's opinion, to the shameful Republicans out there and others, this is beyond the pale what they have done to this woman.
Yeah.
This is beyond the pale.
I don't disagree, but you have to keep in mind that, you know, there are some folks who think that folks like you and me, Gary,
got it.
You know,
I understand that.
All those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
I'll give it a shot.
Because, you know, they're undermining everything.
But yeah. I think we're...
There you go.
The great
Bill O'Reilly saying that you and I should be dragged off in chains, Gary.
Yeah, however, I heard what you said, and they have no basis of truth for that. I think what's bothering them, if you will, in all due respect, great Americans, a lot of great, this is sad, that I think in a lot of ways, and I really believe this, I think a lot of ways, not like me, but a lot of ways they're trying to be like you and others, and they just don't know how to get there. The truth is killing them.
Well,
literally.
Yeah, and I think so. I think there's a lot of dissonance, internal dissonance. Gary, thank you for the call. I think there's a lot of internal dissonance with these folks. And you know, my theory, and you've heard me say it before, is that everybody, that all behavior has at its core the desire for a positive outcome, no matter how misguided it may be. And if you can figure out what, you know, their worldview, then you can figure out how they think that what they're doing is somehow positive. That doesn't necessarily justify the behavior, though. And in this case, we've got some really, really bad behavior going on in Washington, D.C., and in the media in the United States right now. Braswell, on his way to Crawford, Texas, a truck driver. Hey, you're live and on the air.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Hey, I'm down here in Crawford, Texas now. I'm a truck driver. I've been hearing this story about this Cindy Sheehan and what's going on. And I'm just giving a shout-out to all the truck drivers out there. If you're coming through Waco, swing by through Crawford and give your support.
There you go.
Yeah, I think it's about time, you know, we all take a stand. And I'm a Gulf War veteran, and, you know, that theory that people putting out there saying that you can't support the if you don't support the troops, you support the troops but not the war, then you don't support the troops. That's not true.
That's right.
I have family that's in the military. I've been in the military, and you know the truth is the truth. Don't matter what side it comes from, whether the right or the left.
You're right.
And right now we need to all take a stand. You know, I learned something early as a Christian. You're gonna stand for something, or you're gonna fall for anything.
Yeah, to paraphrase Ben Franklin. Yep, you're absolutely right, Braswell. Thanks a lot for the call and for showing up down there in Crawford. Cindy, yesterday when we were talking to her on the program, said that to any of the truckers who are coming down, you know, be careful. There's small roads, small area. You may be, I guess one of the truckers said to leave your trailer someplace nearby and just show up in the cab. Not being a trucker, I don't know how all that works, but
yeah.
I'm sure you can make sense of it.
I'm parked out in front of the, right beside the police station right now, so I'm going to go in there and ask them, where can I drop my trailer at?
Really? You're in Crawford, Texas right this minute?
Yeah, I was like 6 miles away when I called, so I'm in front of the Crawford police station right now.
Okay, well, give us a call back and let us know what happens, okay?
Okay.
Okay, great. Braswell, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. I'll let you go talk to the police there in Crawford, Texas. Trey in North Carolina on the line. Hey, Trey, what's up?
I want to, like, echo what the guy just called, what he said.
Yes, sir.
I was thinking that we probably need, like, political inertia, you know, because, like, I was looking at Newton's law, you know, of inertia, and it was saying like a body in motion.
Yeah.
Can't just stay in motion unless actually defined by an outside force.
Yeah, that's actually momentum.
Yeah, I was thinking about like the way, you know, like the special interests in this country right now are pretty much operating unopposed.
Yep.
You know, they just going a straight line. So that's why I'm glad for what Cindy Sheehan, the people down in Crawford, Texas, are doing, because, you know, they're taking a stand.
You're right. They're overcoming the inertia, the passivity of everybody, and generating some momentum in favor of change. You're right.
Yeah, that's all I wanted to say.
Okay. Well, you said it well, Trey. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Robert in Rochester, New York on the line. Hey, Robert.
Hi, Tom. How's it going?
I'm good. What's up?
I'd like to say something about the Cindy Sheehan thing. I think it's very important how much we all stick together on this.
Yes, sir.
And already I'm a serious radio listener, and there's already liberal talk show hosts that are already bashing Cindy a bit because they won't give her, she won't give them the interview or anything like that. I don't know if you ever listen.
I'm sorry, Robert, but I just can't get into it. I don't, you know, about what anybody else is saying on the air. I mean, you take me to task for anything I say on this program, but that's the beginning and end of the discussion that we can have.
I just think that we should all just stick together. I mean, if the righties are all going to stay together, I think that we should too.
Yeah.
And I guess that's just my comment.
Okay.
All right.
Well
you.
Said, Robert. Thank you. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. Amy in San Diego, California. Hey, Amy.
Hey, Tom. I just heard the tail end of your interview with Cindy, and I didn't know if you guys commented on this yet or not, but there is a letter that's going around on the internet that supposedly is from Cindy's family saying that they're ashamed of what she's doing and all this stuff, and it's not signed by anyone's name. It says Cindy's Casey's grandparents, aunts, uncles, and numerous cousins. Do you know if Cindy has seen this, or did you guys talk about this at all, or do you know about it?
I know nothing about it, but I do know that this is fairly typical of the right wing, you know, to generate these kinds of phony documents and put them out there. So it doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, no.
These guys, their absolute strategy always has been. I mean, this goes back to Lee Atwater, the guy who invented the politics of personal destruction on behalf of Reagan and Bush one, and that is destroy the messenger and find a person's strength and tear apart their strongest strength. So John Kerry, his biggest strength, he was a war hero in the Vietnam War. He stood up. You know, he went to war. He fought for his country. He bled for his country. Yeah. He killed for his country. He was a warrior. And so what do? You try to tear that down. And that's what the slimeboat veterans, swiftboat veterans for truth, were all about. And it's just, you know, always go after their strength. And so, of course, they're going to go after Cindy, and they're going to pretend that they're her family. I'm not surprised at all. That's the kind of bottom feeders that we're dealing with here in this administration and in the media that's associated with it. And it's tragic in the United States.
It's truly tragic.
It's a sad day for this country. Amy, thank you for the call. And
thanks, Tom.
Thanks for your comments. Good to hear from you. Danny in Arkansas on the line. Hey, Danny, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I called you about this time last month and asked you to play a clip from the George Galloway rant against Senator, I don't even remember what his name, you know, the oil for food scandal.
Right.
Yeah, and I think it totally relates to what's going on with Cindy down there in Crawford, because it's, I think it's related. And the reason I want to ask you to play it again is because I think it's real simple and it gets to the point. And I think what Cindy's doing is simple and gets to the point. And that's the only thing that Republicans who haven't opened their eyes yet can relate to, is when you're simple, when you get to the point and you don't throw too many facts at them, because if you do, you know, they start, their eyes roll in the back of their head and they start having ADD and everything. But if you could play that for me, I would love it. If not, I understand.
Okay. I'm not sure. Let's see how much time we've got. Right now, no, we don't. I'm sorry, I just don't have the time to play it because we've got a break coming up here in about a minute, 10 seconds. But, I can play. Here's a little beginning of it.
It's a proven fact. It's a proven fact that these forged documents existed and were being circulated amongst right-wing newspapers in Baghdad and around the world in the immediate aftermath of the fall of the Iraqi regime. Now, Senator, I gave my heart and soul to oppose the policy that you promoted. I gave my political life's blood to try to stop the mass killing of Iraqis by the sanctions on Iraq, which killed 1 million Iraqis, most of them children. Most of them died before they even knew that they were Iraqis. But they died for no other reason other than that they were Iraqis, with the misfortune to be born at that time. I gave my heart and soul to stop you committing the disaster that you did commit in invading Iraq. And I told the world that your case for the war was a pack of lies. I told the world that Iraq, contrary to your claims, did not have weapons of mass destruction. I told the world, contrary to your claims, that Iraq had no connection to Al-Qaeda. I told the world, contrary to your claims, that Iraq had no connection to the atrocity on 9/11/2001.
British Member of Parliament George Galloway, 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
First we'll frisk you, then we'll test you. And it won't be so bad if you should fail. Tell my friends I, if they arrest you. Because they've also spent time in jail.
Oh, my. Welcome back. It's Tom Hartman here with you 5 minutes before the hour. I want to give, by the way, Braswell just called us back, the trucker in Texas and in Crawford, Texas. And he said, he told me, I just talked to him during the break, and he said that the sheriff was very accommodating. They told him where to put his rig, and he's now heading over to be with Cindy right now. They've been very helpful there, so apparently no problem. If truckers want to show up in Crawford, Texas and stand with Cindy Sheehan, they are welcome. And in that note, I'm going to give the last couple minutes here to Cindy from her testimony before the United States Congress earlier this year.
I am even more convinced now that this aggression on Iraq was based on a lie of historic proportions and was blatantly unnecessary. The so-called Downing Street memo dated 23 July 2002 only confirms what I already suspected. The leadership of this country rushed us into an illegal invasion of another sovereign country on prefabricated and cherry-picked intelligence. Iraq was no threat to the United States of America, and the devastating sanctions and bombing raids against Iraq were working. As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalists and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote. It looks like George Bush was ready to lead this country into an avoidable war even before he became president. From the expose of the Downing Street memo and the conversations with George Bush from 1999, it seems like the invasion of Iraq and the deaths of so many innocent people were preordained. It appears that my boy Casey was given a death sentence even before he joined the Army in May of 2000. When a president lies to Congress and the American people, it is a serious offense. If the Downing Street memo proves to be true, then it would appear that the president, vice president, and many members of the cabinet deceived the world before the invasion of Iraq. As a result of this alleged lie, over 1,700 brave young Americans who were only trying to do their duties have come home in flag-draped coffins. Images, as if they were ashamed of our children, that our leaders won't even let the American public see.
I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. The Cindy phenomena. This is fascinating. Cindy Sheehan. This is by David Swanson. www.meetwithcindy.org. Cindy Sheehan is the most searched for term on technorati.com. Measured by Alexa.com, Meet with Cindy yesterday was ranked 16,800, was reaching over 100 per million users. This created a graph shooting almost straight up because the site was created Sunday night. In fact, the site has been reduced to one page to try to handle a traffic surge and been unable for the past 24 hours to update it with the page with better info because of the load on the server. The update, when we manage it, he says, will include a link to Cindy Sheehan information on afterdowningstreet.org, which will then be hit hard. Thanks largely to Cindy Sheehan, afterdowningstreet.org is now ranked 69,000, reaching 15 per million users. And GSFP.org, the Gold Star Families for Peace, GSFP.org, is ranked 97,000, reaching 30 per million users. The website MoveOn.org generally has traffic at about that level that Meet with Cindy is hitting right now. But MoveOn has also surged during the Cindy phenomena. Of three surges in growth for MoveOn in the past 3 months, one came when they finally got involved with the Downing Street memos, and the most recent came when they focused on Cindy Sheehan. So, it's interesting. It's happening. It's like getting active. People are doing it. It's a wonderful thing. It's a marvelous thing. So, anyway, I just to point that out. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, if you'd like to call into the program. I want to get into some economic stuff here in just a minute, but first, Mike, leaving Texas. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, I love your show, and I love that Galloway thing. Thanks for playing that.
Sure.
We were in Crawford yesterday. My wife and I are team truck drivers, and we got a chance to go down there. We got to meet Cindy, and she's just wonderful. We gave her a hug, and she took time to just talk to us about our lives, and it's just a bunch of people. It's not like it's a big organized thing or anything, but
Bill O'Reilly's convinced it's a conspiracy being organized by Michael Moore.
I didn't see Michael Moore anywhere around.
Yeah.
I didn't see the New York Times or anything. It's just people just wandering in, and actually quite a few showed up yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah,
but okay. Nobody seemed connected to any big group or anything. And, you know, we just all kind of wanted to go out there and show our support.
Yep. This is the power of one woman speaking truth. As George Orwell said, in times of universal deceit, telling the truth becomes a revolutionary act. And he's absolutely right. Mike, thanks for the call, and thanks for stopping by Crawford and saying hi to Cindy. Good on you.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Ellen in Humboldt County on the line. Hey, Ellen, what's on your mind today?
Tom, we heard from you that we are not just in Iraq and Afghanistan, but are also in all the neighboring countries, the other stands. We are not hearing about this. And if I heard right, all these countries want us to leave. Did we hear this correct? And if so, is it still a fact?
Somehow I think it is. I think absolutely it is.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you for the call.
Okay.
It's great to hear from you. Yes. Tom in Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Yesterday, did you happen to see George Will's column?
I did not.
George Will, for the first time, has denied that he was the person who stole Jimmy Carter's plan for the debate with Ronald Reagan.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
But at the same time, after denying that he was the one who stole it, and, of course, Jimmy Carter has been saying he's the one who has stole it. He said, in reviewing it, it wasn't worth anything anyway. And so pretty much admitted that he at least had it in his possession. And in my thoughts, I'm not an attorney, but I always thought knowingly possessing stolen goods makes you a felon as well.
Yeah.
And so it was interesting to me that these right-wing sanctimonious people fall victim to their own column. So if you get a chance to look at his column yesterday, it'll be, I think, August 10th.
I'll check it out, Tom. Interesting. Thank you. Thank you for call and for the info. Yeah, George Will possessing stolen documents. Joseph Perkins all of a sudden stopped writing his column as soon as this came out that the Reich Wing was funding conservative columnists. Maybe there's an association there, maybe not. I don't know. I suspect that there is, but I don't have any inside knowledge. We certainly know that others, Armstrong Williams among them, same situation. Rush Limbaugh and his OxyContin. Now, all that said, none of us are without our failures and our foibles. I don't think that any of us are anything less than human beings. It's just sometimes the level of hypocrisy reaches such a point that it's hard to deal with. That said, I think one of the largest issues that we are facing in the United States right now, in addition to war, they talk about guns and butter, right? In addition to war, is the issue of how are we going to survive as a country economically? Grover Norquist laid it out, their strategy, the strategy of the cons that started with Ronald Reagan. They want to destroy democracy in the United States. Because in their mind, what you and I would call democracy, in their mind, is in the way of their rule. They don't want there to be a government of the United States responsible to we the people. They want the power of government to be responsive only to a corporate few, to a select few. And this, and frankly, this is the conservative position has been ever since the founding of this country. Alexander Hamilton and John Adams were pretty upfront about it. John Adams referred to the average person as the rabble. He said, we can't allow a day to come when the rabble actually are allowed to rule. It's why they argued so strongly in the Constitutional Convention in 1787, the conservatives, against allowing the rabble to vote for the United States Senate. And they were successful. We could not vote for senators in the United States until 1917. And the reason why? Well, because the conservatives figured it's just not all that safe to allow the rabble to vote. And we couldn't vote for president. We still can't. Bush v. Gore, when George Bush sued Al Gore and at the Supreme Court to stop the vote count in Florida, the Supreme Court ruled that we have no constitutional right to vote for president of the United States. And we don't. Now we have the right to vote for the Senate because the Constitution was amended in 1917. But the only other branch that you can vote for is the House of Representatives. That's been, from day one. So the conservative position has traditionally been, this is just the basic conservative take, that a ruling elite should be running the country, that's the way you have social stability. Now, the way that modern conservatives differ from traditional European conservatives is that the traditional European conservatives said, yes, there should be a ruling elite that runs the country, but that ruling elite should be hereditary, that there is something genetic that is passed along, that the ruling elite train their children in concepts like noblesse oblige, the idea that because you are born into wealth and riches, you have a certain obligation to take care of the rabble in a way that doesn't cause them to rise up, that they will be raised in and taught to do the things that will prevent there from being social explosions. The mistakes that Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette made, that those would generally, that was an aberration, that was a mistake, that generally those mistakes are are avoided. So the European conservatives, like Sir Edmund Burke, for example, who had a long debate with Thomas Paine in the late 1780s, 1790s, much of which is still intact, the letters between the two of them. He was saying it's important that there be a ruling class and that it be a hereditary ruling class. The American conservatives, on the other hand, like John Adams and Alexander Hamilton, they believe that there should be an aristocratic ruling class, but it should be, instead of a hereditary ruling class, it should be a meritocracy. That the rulers should be the people who had demonstrated their ability to rule by virtue of their intelligence or their wealth, and that wealth was a sign of intelligence. And then, of course, out of Massachusetts in the 16 and 1700s, there was still the Puritans left over, who had fled Europe, who had fled England after, you know, Cromwell and the attempt to take over. Well, it wasn't just an attempt. They did it for, what, 7 years? They controlled England, I believe. Maybe it was 5 years. The religious Reich controlled England, and finally the British said, enough of that. We want our king back. And so the Puritans came to the United States, and they ruled Massachusetts. And so they were saying that not just a meritocracy, but a theocracy. You should have, the ruling class should be those who are ordained by God. And that the proof that somebody who is not a priest is blessed by God is the fact that they're rich. That's the Calvinist notion. I mean, the original notion of John Calvin, that riches, material riches, are a sign of the blessing of God. So anyhow, this is the line of cleavage. Liberals, on the other hand, progressives, traditional American liberals like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and John Jay and George Mason, they believed that if you leave it up to the people, assuming that you have an educated populace and you create institutions to do that, like public education, and you subsidize the news media, and we've been doing that since the founding of this country. We actually used to subsidize the printing, the manufacture of newsprint, and since the 1770s, we've been subsidizing the cost of postage of newspapers. If you have an educated populace, you can trust the people. You can trust the rabble. Thomas Jefferson's famous saying, I will always put my trust in the people. They, not the rich, will be the salvation of our country. And so, you know, there's that cleavage, that line of demarcation between the two. And the conservatives have traditionally said, no, we have to have this small ruling class. And that's the core of conservative economics. So when Grover Norquist said, we're not trying to destroy government in America. We merely, and this he said in 2002, he was talking to Mara Liasson on NPR's Morning Edition program, and he said, we're not trying to destroy democracy in America. We just want to shrink it down to the size where we can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub. Now think about that for a minute. Government is we the people, at least in a liberal democracy. And government performs the functions of maintaining the commons, making sure that the air is clean, the water is pure, the food is safe, the doctors are ethical, you know, etc. That we maintain the roads and things. If government is shrunk down to the size where it's drowned in the bathtub, who's going to do all that stuff? The police departments, the fire departments, the education. It will be opportunities for profit, on the one hand, Grover Cleveland and his buddies, and opportunities for control. Power again going to that meritocracy, to that aristocracy, to that small elite, the Wall Street Journal bunch, the conservatives, the Bill O'Reillys of the world, who then will, you know, tell everybody, pat them on the head and say, oh, and if you speak out against, undermine George W. Bush, that's treason. You can't do that. That group. Ultimately, it comes back to economics. And after the break, I want to share with you the voice of a victim of the economic policies of Reagan, Bush, some of the economic policies of Clinton, and certainly George W. What happens when conservative economics rule a nation? 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you at today's Ask the White House. This is yesterday from the Think Progress blog. Director of the National Economic Council and Assistant to President for Economic Policy, Al Hubbard, showed his conservative, compassionate side. Bobby from Dallas, Texas said, quote, everybody keeps talking about how the economy is growing and so good, yet I've been out of work for 6 to 12 months now. I'm a legal assistant with 15 years of experience. Law firms seem to be looking for people with 2 to 5 years of experience so they can pay them less. I need a job now. What help is there for me? And so Al Hubbard, the director of the National Economic Council and assistant to the president for economic policy, said, and I quote, as I mentioned in my opening statement, the job situation has improved dramatically over the last 2 years. Just last month, the economy created over 200,000 new jobs. My suggestion to you is to remain persistent in your job hunt, and I'm sure you'll find the right job for you. Yeah. A.J. Montini is a brilliant writer for the Arizona Republic, a newspaper in Phoenix, Arizona. And A.J. did a column 2 years ago about a call that he got on his answering machine at the Arizona Republic. And this is the call. He put it on his website, and I want to salute A.J. for doing that. This is an anonymous caller. He doesn't know who it was who called into him. But it so brilliantly summarizes the situation right now.
Voice call received 9:37 a.m. Tuesday, March 2nd. 2 minutes. To listen, press 0.
I'm calling in, and I'm promising myself not to cry, but y'all's right about things that are going on in the current events, and I'm wondering, has anybody noticed in America, all of us that are unemployed? I'm 43 years old, and I've been working since I was 16. My husband is 45. We've been married 22 years, and we've always worked. A year ago, I lost my job. 6 months ago, his job was outsourced to India. We have three children, one that's 18, and we were going to try to help them get through college, but anyway, I just wonder, there's so many of us, and people don't seem to notice what's going on, and nobody, see, I read the paper, and I don't see a lot of people writing about it, and I know there's a lot of them out there, because I talk to my friends every day that I used to work with, and there are no jobs. And it just seems like somebody ought to write that a lot of jobs have gone overseas, and there's no jobs in this country for people that have worked all their lives. And, I mean, yesterday I was on the phone looking around for shelters, because we've got another 2 months before we're going to get thrown out of our house. And we were part of that middle class section there. This wasn't, I mean, I never thought this was supposed to happen to us. And I know there's a lot of people out there like us. So anyway, it'd be neat if somebody would write and make the country aware that, I feel like invisible. You go to the grocery store and it's like, see, we were an invisible section, but I think there's like millions of us. So anyway, somebody ought to write about it. And you always write about everything, and you make it good. And nobody hears us. So what?
To respond or forward, press 1. To delete, press star D.
A.J. Montini's phone call on his answering machine. And he wrote a brilliant piece about it for the Arizona Republic. I believe it's still on their website. And certainly you can Google it. And there's a link to it from our chat, from our message board. You go to tomharbin.com and click on message board and search on A.J. Montini. It's been there for a while. So yesterday, George Bush bragging about the jobs creation, 207,000 new jobs in July. Well, 26,000 of those were tax-supported government jobs, 13% of them. That leaves 181,000 jobs in the private sector. Turns out 30,000 were for bartenders and food servers, 28,000 health care and social assistance, this is by Paul Craig Roberts, 12,000 in real estate, 6,000 in credit intermediation, which is like bill collecting, 8,000 in transportation, 50,000 in retail trade, and 8,000 in wholesale trade. In other words, not one single manufacturing job. What has happened to the infrastructure of this country? We'll get into that in just a minute. It's 29 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I was burned out from exhaustion, buried in the hail, poisoned in the bushes and blown out on the trail. Hunted like a crocodile, ravaged in the corn. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 27 minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, tomhartman.com. The website, you are in the democracy zone, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. The True People's Radio, the place where smart people get their news. And what can we do about the economy? Well, it's some very simple, straightforward things that are not new ideas that had to be thought up by some folks sitting around going, gee, what, you know, let's come up with some radical new solution. No, it's the old-fashioned stuff that worked in the past. It's time for us to go back to the old-fashioned stuff that worked in the past. It's very straightforward. Number one, you have a progressive income tax. So, you know, you say, hey, you know, if you're making money, great. If you're making a lot of money, great. If you make a whole huge pile of money, that's fine. You are enjoying the blessings of this country, but you are also using very heavily the infrastructure. Our political system, our court system, our Treasury Department, things like this, you're making great use of them. Marvelous. You can help pay for them in proportion to your use of them. So as incomes go up, taxes go up. Why don't we go back to the taxes that we had during the golden age of the American middle class? And that was a top tax rate, top marginal tax rate of between 70% and 90%. John Kennedy dropped it down to 70%, but he made it very clear when he did so that he was doing that because most people were not paying not only were most people not paying 90%, the millionaires and billionaires, they weren't even paying 70%. And so, you know, the cons will say, well, look at this. John Kennedy lowered the top income tax rate from 90%, which is where it was from the 1930s until 1962. He lowered it from 90% down to 70%, and tax revenues went up in the United States when he lowered the top tax rate. That's true. But the reason that the revenues went up was because he plugged loopholes. And Kennedy was outspoken about that. You've heard me play the clips on this program of him debating Nixon and talking about that and just saying, you know, this is where I stand. People are misrepresenting my position. He said, you know, he's in that category of folks who are making those kind, you know, who have that kind of income. He said, you know, people in this category are not paying their share of taxes. He closed so many loopholes that people in the 50% and above tax bracket actually started paying more taxes, and thus revenues went up. I mean, this isn't rocket science. You increase taxes, you increase government revenue. Obviously, there's a point, if you have 100% tax, where you increase taxes up to the point where there's no government revenue. You know, this is a curve, and Alvin Lafler was correct about that, but the points, a beginning point and the ending point of that curve, they're not exactly the way that Reagan would have it, as it were. In other words, if you have if your tax rate is zero, you have no revenues. If your tax rate is 100%, you're going to have no revenue either. Because, I mean, you know, nobody's going to work for 100%, you know, if there's no paycheck, right? But there is that kind of, and the way you do it is with a progressive income tax. You know, the first $100,000, the first $1 million, you pay a lower tax rate on. And then your second million or your fifth million or your tenth million, then you start paying higher taxes on. So number one, let's go back to the progressive tax we had. I mean, I would be perfectly willing to pay the taxes I paid when Bill Clinton was president if I had the economy that we had when Bill Clinton was president as well, rather than having these horrible deficits. Or for that matter, pay the taxes we had during the Kennedy administration, and let's have an economy where a single person working full-time can raise a family, put their kids through school, pay for all their medical expenses, have a pension, and take a vacation. Step one, you know, fix our tax policies. Let's stop living on the credit card. We're now $7 trillion in debt as a result of Reaganomics, trickle-on economics. It is not trickling on us the way it's supposed to. I'm sorry. Number two, our trade policies. David Ricardo, back in the 1700s, you know, there were two famous economists who came out of the late 1700s. The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith was one, and David Ricardo, he wrote several different books, but Ricardo's idea, Ricardo was in favor of free trade, but he said, as was Adam Smith, but both of them made the point very clearly. Ricardo with a little more eloquence than Smith, because Smith is pretty dense, pretty hard to read. Ricardo made the point that free trade among nations only works to the benefit of all the nations involved, when all of those nations have similar standards of living and similar wage bases. So, for example, you know, trade between the United States and Canada, it's going to work to the benefit of the United States and Canada. But trade between the United States and, say, Mexico is going to work disproportionately to the benefit of Mexico and to the harm of the United States. Why? Because because our economy, it depends on how you define who gets harmed. It's going to work to the harm of the working people of the United States. It'll work to the benefit of the ownership class in the United States, of the corporations. Because labor is one of those products that is, in effect, being traded. So you have the conservatives taking the position that, hey, it's just fine. Let's have 10 million illegal immigrants here that'll drive down wages. And let's ship offshore as many of our jobs as we can into countries where people are desperate and will work for poverty wages. That's just wrong. Countries have their own unique economies that are based on a whole bunch of different things that have to do with their natural resources, that have to do with their geography, that have to do with their history and their traditions, that have to do it's just a whole collection of things. And when you just tear down all the barriers, all you are doing, the only group that benefits are the multinational corporations. Free trade, the New World Order of George Herbert Walker Bush, free trade, so-called free trade, is not free. There's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of pages of regulations involved in NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO. It's not free. But it is very heavily skewed to the benefit of big multinational corporations, and it screws the American worker. We need to just throw these things away. Just literally walk away from them. George Bush Jr. taught us that we can walk away from treaties. He came into the office, he said, what's this anti-ballistic missile treaty? It's kept us, you know, safe from the Soviet Union for all these years. We don't need that. And he walked away from it. What is this Kyoto Accord? Bill Clinton has signed this thing. We're going to unsign it. We're going to undo it. We're going to walk away. We don't need no stinking treaties. We can walk away from NAFTA. We can walk away from GATT and the WTO. We can walk away from CAFTA. We can simply say, no, we're not going to be a signatory to these treaties any longer. And go back to the way that it was done in this country for 200 years, where you look at industry by industry and you say, okay, there's some industries in the United States that it's really important that we keep here, those that have good-paying jobs, that will help create a strong middle class. Those that will provide for self-sufficiency. Self-reliance is a good value. You know the old family farm thing? My wife's grandmother, Louise's grandmother, had a farm in central Michigan, and they used to spend the weekends there when Louise was growing up. And she's told me 100 times a story about how, you know, all grandma ever did, you know, once a year she'd buy a dress from Sears, and twice a year they'd go into town to buy salt and sugar. And that was it. Everything else they grew on the farm. They were and she made her own clothes. I mean, she was self-reliant. That's a high value. As a nation, we should be self-reliant. We should say, okay, what are our energy needs? We're consuming 25% of the world's energy. We are 4% of the world's population. We're importing more than half of all the oil that we're using. We have huge energy resources here in the United States. There's enough sunlight south of the Mason-Dixon line to power the entire United States. If we just started encouraging people to replace roofing tiles with solar panels. And now there are companies, Sanyo, for example, making and Shell Oil, making roofing tiles that are solar panels. You nail them down just as if they were roofing panels. They look like roofing panels. They generate electricity. I mean, they look like roofing shingles. Excuse me, not panel shingles. In a half a dozen states just east of the Rockies, there's enough wind power to power the entire United States. Well, you're not going to be able to transmit it with big high tension lines, or the Mojave Desert. There's a mind-boggling amount of solar power. So if we, in those places, we took all that electricity that could be generated in these central locations that is just going to waste right now and used it with electrolysis, you know, you run electricity through water to split water into hydrogen and oxygen, capture all that hydrogen, compress it, turn it, you know, liquefy it. It's not that different from propane gas. I mean, it's, you know, we know how to deal with liquefied gases. And now you've got to start making cars that run on it. Now you have an economy based on hydrogen. And you don't need to mine hydrogen. You don't need to buy it from some other country. You don't need to import it from Saudi Arabia. You can make it from solar power in the Mojave Desert or from wind power in Colorado. Pretty much every state has some way of extracting energy that can be used like this. So, you know, rational trade policies, rational domestic energy policies, and as far as the trade policies go, you know, up until the time of the Civil War, virtually the entire funding for the federal government was from tariffs. The first tax, the first income tax was actually passed to pay for the Civil War. It was entirely tariffs. The way the tariffs worked was we said, okay, there are some industries that we actually need to have. We need to have the ability to manufacture clothing in this country. We've lost that. We've given that away. We need to have the ability to manufacture computers in this country. We've lost that. We've given it away. We need to have the ability to manufacture automobiles in this country. We're losing that. We need to have the ability in this country to manufacture precision machine parts, precision tools and dies and things. We're giving that away. We've lost so much of that. We need to have in this country the ability to manufacture our own defense products, our own, you know, airplanes. Boeing is now making airplanes in China. GM is making engines in China. Chevy engines made in China. Why don't we just look at these industries and say, you know, you want to make it in China, that's fine, but when you import it into the United States, say that engine that you're going to manufacture in China, say you can make that engine in China for $150 because labor is so cheap over there, and it'll cost you $350 to make it here. That's fine, you can make it in China, but when you import it, there's a $200 tax, a tariff. And that money goes into the coffers of the federal government to help pay for our roads and our schools and for national health plan and to keep this country strong. That's how this government was funded entirely up until the Civil War, and at least half of our funding clear through the time of Teddy Roosevelt. In fact, all the way up to World War I from tariffs. Tariffs were still a significant source of revenue until Reagan came along. Well, really, it was Clinton who kicked the door wide open, but, you know, Reagan and Bush started the deterioration. So let's go back to protecting domestic industries by tariffs. And people say, well, then the price of that engine block is going to go up. Yes, but you're going to have people working, making those engine blocks, and they'll be able to afford them. And you see how the cycle works? I mean, you're either spiraling down or you're spiraling up. And in this case, what I'm describing, the old-fashioned way, the way that we did it for 200 years in the United States until Reagan came along with Reaganomics, the old-fashioned way is a spiral up. Every generation, you know, you can rely that your children are going to have more opportunity than you had. That was the American way. That's how we did it in this country for so long. And you say, what are the industries that we want to protect? And then we say, okay, if you want to make that product, whatever it may be, offshore, you can do that, but you're going to have to pay a tax when you import it to equalize the cost of labor. And what happens is the standard of living in the United States starts to rise because wages start to rise. Prices are rising, yes, but wages are rising as well. And so now the standard of living in America is higher. Now, what does that do with regard to illegal immigration? Well, now, if you have a higher standard of living and you have and you allow labor to organize, as we did from 1935 until Reagan came along and declared war on organized labor, organized labor unions become the bulwark against illegal immigration. The reason, we had a wide open border with Mexico and Canada back 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, and we were not being flooded with illegal immigrants. Right now, 10% of the entire GDP of Mexico is money being sent home to families. We have between 10 and 20 million illegal immigrants in the United States right now. Now, it's not their fault. I'm not bashing them. It's not about race, this or that or the other thing. Although, you know, there's a lot of right-wingers that would make you think it. It's because we have insane labor practices in the United States. 30, 40 years ago, nobody would have tried to cross the border to come here because they knew that the only kind of job that they could have gotten was an illegal job picking strawberries or something. And, you know, there was only a small number of people who were willing to do that. Now they can come over and get a job as a carpenter. They can get a job as a pipe fitter. They can get a job working in an auto factory. They can get a job working for Walmart. They know that because their labor unions are not the first line of defense any longer, that there's possibility. What does that do? It destroys our job market. So the answer isn't to build, you know, fences and have guys with guns down there at the border. The answer is to change our labor policies. So this, you know, here, it is so straightforward. If we simply look back, I mean, look back at the writings of Adam Smith and David Ricardo from the 1700s. Look at how it worked in the 1800s and the 1900s, and the, you know, how we built the most powerful economy on earth. When Ronald Reagan came into office, more countries owed us more money than any other country in the history of the world. We were the world's banker. We were the biggest creditor in the world. Now, 25 years after, you know, 25 years of Reaganomics, of trickle-on economics, and we are the biggest debtor in the world. We are $7 trillion in debt. We're running a $600 billion a year trade deficit. We are borrowing from China so that we can buy things from China, so that we can send our jobs to China. It's crazy. It's not good national policy. It's not good defense policy. It's not good economic policy. It is a downward spiral. That's what conservative economics have brought us. That's what Rush Limbaugh has brought us. That's what the cons in Congress have brought us. That's what Newt Gingrich has brought us. And that's what we've got to stop. That's what we have to change. And the way we do it, very simple, very straightforward. Change our trade policies, re-empower labor, have a decent minimum wage in the United States. And walk away from these crazy treaties, these so-called free trade treaties. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And who's going to be the one to say it was no good what we done? I dare a man to say I'm too young, for I'm going to try for the sun.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 5 minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, and Mike in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. One quick point. I agree with your analysis of why we're being overrun by immigrants, but there's one little thing I think you left out. It's the fact that the way that we are running our capitalist system, we go into other countries, destroy the system, the economic system they have, milk their economy for everything we can, and then when we've totally destroyed their economy, these people have nowhere to work. Their traditional jobs are gone. Their traditional way of life is gone.
Yeah,
their economy is gone.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, between the maquiladora system of, you know, building these factories just across the border in northern Mexico, and then outsourcing those factories to China, you know, when we shifted from NAFTA to GATT, and by subsidizing the production of corn in the United States so that we can sell, even with the cost of shipping, we can sell American corn in Mexico for less than local small farmers can grow it for, and thus putting out of business millions of small farmers in Mexico. We've created massive poverty in that country, and that is one of the things that's driving the pressure for illegal immigration in the United States. But the reality is that those illegal immigrants would not be coming into the United States if they couldn't find jobs.
That's true.
They would instead, Mexico would have to deal with social unrest, and that's what Vicente Fox doesn't want to have to deal with. That's why he's publishing a brochure about how to sneak across the border without getting caught and without hurting yourself.
Right. And the problem of it is, at the rate that we're exporting our own jobs to cheap labor markets, we're going to cut off the influx of foreigners because there won't be any jobs for Americans, much less for anybody else.
Yeah, that lowest common denominator is not that far away. Actually, there is quite a bit of difference between us and Central America, for example. I mean, you know, more than half of the 44 million people in Central America live on less than $2 a day. So I guess we're going to have to drop quite a bit before it's all equalized and the multinational corporations have a total heyday. The problem is that who's going to be the consumers? You know, who's going to buy the products when you wiped out the middle class of all these different countries? It's just, it's an economic theory that makes no sense, Mike. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. It's the conservative economics. For 25 years now, we've been able to watch it. We've been able to see the results. And tragically, the mistakes are being now repeated in Europe. You know, Tony Blair with his new Labour. The Germans are about to elect a prime minister who is espousing conservative economic policies. They've been going down that road for about 10 years now. It's killing them. It's happening all over the world. The cons, the multinational corporations, pushing this down their throats, and it's harming the world.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you for the third hour of our program. Broadcasting live on radio stations all across the United States on Sirius Satellite Radio, RadioPower.org, Live 365's American FM, WhiteRoseSociety.org, and CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. George Bush is holding a news conference at the moment. I was listening to pieces of it during the break. Rather sad. He did get asked about Cindy Sheehan, and he very artfully deflected the question. He characterized her question as, why don't we get out of Iraq now? To the best of my knowledge, Cindy Sheehan has never said that. She has said instead, Mr. President, what is the noble mission for which my son died? And if it's so noble, why don't you send your daughters, who are unemployed and of military age? But no, as far as I could tell, none of the reporters had the cojones to say, Mr. Bush, I'm sorry, you're mischaracterizing her question. Here's what her question is. Why don't you answer it? So, you know, as usual, the White House press corps scared to death that if they ask a hard question, George won't call on them in the future, and therefore they won't have a job. They won't be able to, it's just the rule of survival, this administration being the first in history to actually to manipulate the press corps. That, you know, with those threats of loss of access, really quite tragic. But for just a few minutes, we're going to come back to this, and I also want to get back to what's happening with Justice Sunday. This should be entertaining, and some of the economic issues and your calls as well. But first, it's Thursday afternoon, and every Thursday afternoon we take a few minutes to talk about the things that maybe you thought you knew, but you didn't really know that you didn't know, or you didn't know you needed to know, or you didn't know what you didn't know that you didn't know, but you know that there is something that you don't know. Maybe even what you think you know is not even right.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be? Is your computer spying on you? Alex Eckelberry is with us. Hey, Alex.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on the show.
I'm pleased to have you here. Alex Eckelberry, a recognized and quoted authority on internet security issues, especially in spyware. Alex, you have a website?
Yeah, well, I have a company. I hate spyware.com is the website, but my company is Sunbelt Software, and we make anti-spyware and anti-spam tools.
Okay, so I would guess that you're familiar with this. I hate spyware.com, your website. What are the probabilities that as I move around the internet, I'm being followed?
High.
High?
Hi. Yeah, I mean, you know, surveys indicate that, you know, it, the majority of people on the internet right now have some form of spyware. Now, that can also be a very alarmist viewpoint. I mean, the reality is a lot of these programs are not dangerous and harmful, and some of them are. There's different shades of gray when it comes to spyware, and a lot of people just refer to this type of program as adware. Now, basically, the symptoms are your computer is slower, lots of pop-ups, it's crashing, and really bad forms of spyware infestations. You can't get on the internet, or you get on and your search page has changed. You've got some weird search bar there. You're having all types of trouble navigating the internet. That's very bad spyware infestation. And, you know, this stuff is all fueled by money.
You know, I bought a brand new computer, a year or so ago. And I put SpyBot Search and Destroy on it, you know, which is an anti-spyware program, much like the stuff that you guys sell over at IHateSpyware.com.
Mm-hmm.
I put this program on it. This is brand new. It had not even been plugged into the internet. Just right out of the box, put on an anti-spyware program, and it found 46 pieces of spyware pre-installed on this.
Well, a lot of those.
What's the deal?
Well, a lot of those are cookies, and you know, I don't want to scare people about cookies. They tend to be fairly innocuous, fairly harmless, but they're still, you know, their privacy experts have debates about, you know, cookies and how much they compromise your privacy.
Well, there's a difference between a passive cookie and an active cookie, is there not?
Well, they're really, actually, what you're talking about there, you pick up a good point. You're talking about third-party cookies, and that's where you have, like, an advertiser puts a cookie and then, you know, sees that you're visiting websites that, say, sell baby formula or something like that, and then may deliver you targeted ads based on that preference. Cookies really aren't the major issue, and I think my industry has been maybe a little using too many scare tactics in that area. Really, the real issue is these programs that get on your computer, and these are programs. Cookies are just little text files. But these are programs that sit on your computer and turn your computer into an advertising kiosk for someone else. And many of them are installed in a pernicious manner that it does not provide adequate disclosure and actually can actually do harm to the Internet experience.
Yeah, and usually these are attached to shareware programs, are they not? Here's free software. All you have to do is click this agreement, and nobody reads the 36 pages of fine print, and the agreement says, by the way, you're going to be installing a program on your computer that's going to track everything that you do and is going to tell us about it.
And usually it's going to track your behavior to deliver advertising, and you know, and I'm sorry, I mean, I think a lot of people have a problem with the fact that there's a program tracking the fact that you're going to BarnesandNoble.com, then you're going to Amazon, and oh, it sees you're looking for a book by John Grisham. Okay, here's a special offer in a book by John Grisham. I'm not saying, by the way, that Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble are giving spyware. I'm saying that these programs are tracking the types of behavior you have, and it's called behavioral advertising. It's a very fancy term, behavioral marketing. Well, you know, first of all, you've got something tracking, which, you know, okay, maybe it's used anonymously. You could argue the privacy issues there. But who wants something on your machine that's tailoring advertisements based on what they think you want? And it's also, at the same time, very likely going to slow your machine down, cause pop-ups, and cause your machine to crash. I mean, it's a real problem.
We're talking with Alex Eckelberry of IHateSpyware.com. Alex, to what extent is the government involved in this?
Well, Sonny Bono's wife, Mary Bono, Representative Mary Bono in California, has introduced a piece of legislation called the Spy Act. And, you know, there's sort of that's probably a longer interview to talk about that one. I don't have great hopes for legislation. We're seeing a lot of the really nasty spyware variants come offshore from Russia and from, you know, China. And these, there's even inklings of some sort of criminal association. And
But I understand. I've read about, for example, that there are programs, anti-pornography programs, particularly anti-child pornography programs, dirty bomb programs, whatever. At least this is, verify this for me, okay? I don't know if this is a rumor or if this is real, that if you visit, say, a certain website that has bomb-making instructions, and you download a text file that tells you how to make a dirty bomb, that website might have been put there by the FBI, and that text file might actually contain a little program that sits on your computer and then lets the FBI know everything you're doing from that point forward, and that's stuff that's allowed for, and that might even be a desirable thing. I mean, it was a debate that we could have in our society about, you know, to what extent do we want to be spying on ourselves, but to what extent is that real? Is that happening?
I don't think that's. That's not an issue that I've run across, but you bring up a good point. I mean, the FBI does set up sting operations. You know, really, obviously, their focus is on, you know, things like child pornography are a huge focus for them, and that's a very laudable effort. There's certainly going to be these types of attempts to try to find out what people are doing, but I don't see keyloggers, which is really what you're referring to, as being out there. It's possible. I mean,
So a keylogger is a program that tracks your every time you hit a key on the keyboard. It's tracking your finger motions, right?
Yes, and if you have a keylogger in your system, it's an extremely serious thing. I mean, it is. It's immediately shut down your computer.
And how does it get there? And how do you know it?
Well, keyloggers tend to sort of crawl over into the antivirus space. Antivirus, anti-spyware are actually almost coming close together in terms of the types of threats, and they can get on through silent means. You can also have a spouse put on a keylogger on someone's machine to track their activities, and for example, see if they're being true.
Well, I've heard that some companies do this. They put keyloggers into the computers that people use at work, so that they can track everything that's going on in that person's computer.
Yes, And I've used keyloggers myself and my own kids. You know, I've got four children. They're on the internet, and occasionally I'll throw a keylogger in a machine and make sure they're not, you know, getting picked up by some weirdo. I mean, you do that in the course of parenting. You may want to actually do that.
Right.
But the problem is, I mean, and anti-spyware programs are notorious for falsely identifying keyloggers, by the way. That's a tip for your users. If you have an anti-spyware program, any one of them, mine included, that says you have a keylogger, look very closely at it, because it's a very serious issue. And the reason, because we're all trying to guess what's on your computer, and sometimes, occasionally, we'll make a false guess. So if it's a keylogger, you know, really check out the file, call the company, say, I've got this file, is this really a keylogger, and then take the adequate steps. Because at that point, you got to shut off your computer and take action.
Right. Alex Eckelberry, we're talking about computers in this context and spyware and computers, yet the federal government just, there was a piece of legislation passed, the Omnibus Spending Bill, the big, you know, fund the government bill that was passed last month, that had attached to it the Real ID Act, which says that within the next 5 years, all the states have to come up with driver's licenses that have embedded in them radio frequency ID chips, RFID chips, so that, you know, that are essentially transponders that contain your personal information. So literally now, 5 years from now, as you walk by Macy's, or as you walk through Macy's, for example, just, and, you know, not to pick on Macy's, but just for a name, as you walk through, they can tell where you lingered. Alex likes to stand in the area where they sell fishing reels, or he's partial to the ladies' bras, or whatever, you know, and then the next store, and then the next store, and aren't we just moving toward the exact same thing that's being done with computer spyware, where they're profiling our behavior in a more real world environment?
Yeah,
is now the time to be drawing the line on this, or on the other hand, to say, okay, that's the kind of society we're willing to have?
Well, no, I mean, you're entering a realm that I have fairly passionate ideas on. It may be a subject that we would, you know, may not want to get into, because I have written about this Real ID Act, and I am actually very disturbed by it, as a person involved in privacy issues. I'm extremely disturbed by it, actually. I mean, I really believe that we have hard-won freedoms that we're rapidly losing. And, you know, what the software companies are doing, there's a company called Claria out there, okay? Claria is a well-known adware company. And they have a product called Gator, which is an e-wallet. You know, you can type in credit card numbers and it does it automatically for you. Well, these guys are masters of behavioral marketing. And if you go to their website and flip through their presentations they give to advertisers, look at the types of things they're looking for. They have beautiful models that they've created, not female models, you know, mathematical models on buying and behavior and habits online. You've got this little Gator e-wallet program in your system, and it's part of a massive Borg that's tracking activity on over 40 million people on the internet. Now, it's anonymous, and Claria wouldn't dare take personal information because they'd be out of business these days.
But still, you're part of the Matrix. You're welcome to the Matrix. Alex, we're out of time. It's been very informative. Alex Eckelberry, IHateSpyware.com. Is that right?
That's it.
Okay. Alex Eckelberry, thanks a lot for being with us today, Alex. Is your computer spying on you? Are we living in a society of spying on each other? What's coming down the road? Oh, my goodness. It's 20 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program. You're listening to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Here's the story of a corporation that has newspapers in every place you go. It also owns a couple cable stations, a movie studio.
And they wanted somebody to merge with.
And there was another corporation that controlled all access to the internet. One day these corporate giants formed a merger.
Yes. Welcome back, my friends. 26 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Billionaires for Bush there. The Time Warner, AOL Time Warner merger song. Charlene Espinosa is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, our correspondent in Washington, D.C. Hey, Charlene.
How are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Excellent.
What's up? What's happening in Washington, D.C. that we need to know about? I know that George is having his news conference down there in Crawford, kind of bumbling through it.
That's right. I guess the biggest buzz around Washington today is about the grieving mother of the fallen Gulf War veteran, Ms. Sheehan, that's camping out at the ranch in Crawford and starting to basically start a movement out there outside the gate until she can see the president. Many people, according to some of the press pool, are joining her, including other vets and other grieving family members.
You know, Charlene, I think that Cindy Sheehan, I think 10, 20 years from now, when we look back at the history of this time, we're going to view Cindy Sheehan the same way we look at Rosa Parks.
I agree. I mean, I was an embedded correspondent during the war and have been back to Iraq since then, traveled in the Middle East, and I was also a Air Force pilot, but I frequently talk with some of the men that I was over there in Iraq with, and this is a growing problem in terms of not just the grieving families, but also some of the wounds that are still basically psychologically being inflicted on a lot of these troops. I was just talking with a friend of mine who's a guard from a guard unit, spent a year over there, and their rates of post-traumatic stress syndrome are significant. You know, many of these men and women go back to their hometowns, just like where you're from, and they try to sort of merge back into civilian life, but their promotions have sort of passed them by, and just essentially suffering some of this anxiety as well as economic duress. And some of them, a couple of them that I was with, have already gone back to Iraq just because they really couldn't sort of integrate back into civilian life.
That's a tough one. It is,
and financially, you know, I'm very fortunate. I'm actually an airline pilot, and by law, the airlines have a very etched-in-stone relationship with the military. So if you leave, for example, for a year, 2 years, 3 years, you keep your seniority, you keep your accruing retirement, and all these other types of benefits. However, in the civilian world, while it's supposed to work that way, it really doesn't. So many of these people end up going back working for contractors in Iraq, just as drivers or what have you.
The second largest army in Iraq, actually, over between 20 and 40,000 people, the mercenary army. Larger
right,
than
I would say that number is actually pretty conservative. In fact, and of course, I think that's the wave of the future. I mean, we sort of got rid of the large standing army back at the end of the Cold War, and we really don't. You look at the new force structure; they don't want to pay for what it takes to pay a large standing army with retirement benefits, etc. So, in fact, there's a new book coming out called "Corporate Warriors." That really shows the pervasive extent of that.
Yeah, we'll have to look for that. Okay, fascinating. Charlene Espinosa, thank you.
Have a
great information
day.
From the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks for the report. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
The Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Iraq is the front in the war against terror. Might be because we invited a mayor. Perhaps there's some terrible clerical error. Maybe a faulty equation. Like 911 equals U.S. invasion.
Yeah, slightly faulty. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. You're in the center of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations. Truth in Broadcasting, our program, The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix. Justice Sunday is on its way. Are you ready for Justice Sunday? Are you ready? Are you ready?
What a friend we have in W.
Ah, yes, my friends.
Upright, strong, and resolute.
Oh, he's so resolute.
God wished him to be our leader. The court could not but follow suit.
Oh, the court, of course, had to do it, you know?
Righteousness has filled our nation. Justice overflowing its rim.
Oh, it's marvelous.
Life doth flourish in all its aspects when we're led by such as him.
Yeah, such a brilliant leader. Good old W.
When the day of choice arrives, victory shall be his again that day.
Tragically, it was.
So since my vote will not be needed, I'll just stay at home and pray.
Don't you wish?
Yes, especially if the weather is inclement. I'll just stay at home and pray.
Yes, well, that's not what the Justice Sunday 2 folks have in mind. Instead, you know, our question, can God save these corrupt Republicans? This Sunday, the Two Rivers Baptist Church in Nashville, Tennessee, is going to host the Family Research Council's simulcast TV program, Justice Sunday 2, God Save the United States in this Honorable Court. The Family Research Council, a right-wing extremist group that defends its stance against American workers, against women's rights, and against civil rights, by claiming that they do all this to promote family values. Yes, indeed. This Sunday, their speakers are going to include the Family Research Council's president, who has ties to the Ku Klux Klan, Dr. James Dobson, who has called Roe v. Wade the world's biggest Holocaust, and Bishop Harry Jackson, who said black churches are too concerned with justice. It's really rather remarkable when you just, you know, consider for a moment the folks who are going to be speaking here and what they're all about. The Family Research Council, their agenda. First of all, they oppose stem cell research. Ken Connor, the president of the Family Research Council, says stem cell research should be stopped because embryos are human life. Yes, even though hundreds of thousands of them are flushed down the sinks in fertility clinics all across the United States every day or every year. And they are so small you need a microscope to see them. As he says, size or age does not define a human being. Doug Johnson of the National Right to Life Committee said stem cell research, like abortion, was killing a life. An abortion takes the life of a human family. Johnson said the embryo who was killed in this stem cell research is an individual member of the human family. Well, I would suggest to him, to Doug Johnson, and to his friends, Ken Connor, president of the Family Research Council, if you feel that way, then, you know, don't allow your wife's embryos. You know, if you decide to have in vitro fertilization, don't allow those extra leftover embryos from the in vitro fertilization to be used for stem cell research. In fact, you know, if you have to fertilize a couple of dozen eggs in order to get a good one, maybe you should implant all 12 of them and have, what would that be, hextuplets? I don't know what 12 is. But, you know, don't impose that on me, thank you very much. And by the way, if you get an illness that's going to be cured with this, don't come asking for any help. The Family Research Council supports ending funding to the National Endowment for the Arts. He says, why should a young family struggling to make ends meet be forced to fund such projects as the lesbian porn film Watermelon Women when, for them, going to a decent movie is a rare treat? Well, one of the reasons that we fund the arts in the United States is that traditionally the arts is not an area that has paid well, and therefore the arts in those societies that have had arts have always been funded. Beethoven, Bach, Schumann, all of these guys, they got their commissions from the royalty of the day. or from the government of the day. Yes, I mean, if you don't, it's like science. It's like if you don't fund basic science, you know, how was the universe created? Of course, this is the kind of basic science these guys don't like. How was the universe created? When was the universe created? How old is the universe? They don't want to know. But if you don't fund basic science, you don't learn a lot of things. I mean, the things that we've learned from the space program, from the Hubble telescope, from just from these giant colliders, the cyclotrons that, you know, it's splitting atoms and figuring out what's going on inside and what are the essential forces of nature. And, you know, you don't start out with something, you know, okay, we're going to make a better widget. I know there's a market for XYZ, right? Whatever it may be. And so I'm going to set out to make it. Most of, in fact, in virtually all cases, basic science doesn't get funded by commerce because there are some things that the marketplace simply doesn't meet the need for. I mean, if I'm an entrepreneur, I'm a small business person, or even a big business person, I'm not going to throw money into basic science because, it might be 15, 20, 30 years before you can make money with the discoveries that you get out of that. That's why we collectively do it. Similarly, if the only art that is out there is art that people pay for, then you're going to have a very narrow spectrum of art available, that art that is called commercial art. And non-commercial art, art that people won't pay for, that doesn't trade well in the market, but still, there may still be some demand for it, will wither on the vine and we will all be the poorer for it. Society will be the poorer for it. I would suggest it's the same thing with broadcasting. In fact, this is one dimension of it. People say, well, you know, why fund public broadcasting? The mandate of public broadcasting in 1964, and here I am in commercial radio talking about public broadcasting. The mandate of public broadcasting was to say, hey, there are markets out there. There are media that are unserved. There are, for example, children's programming back then was unserved. Nobody could figure, you know, the consensus was in the commercial markets, kids don't buy things. We're talking about 4-year-olds, 3-year-olds, 2-year-olds. They don't buy things. They don't make purchasing decisions, so we can't make any money programming for them. So why bother? But as a society, we look at that and say, hey, you know, as a society, there's a need for programming to these kids. Help them learn how to read. Give them a head start, to borrow the name of the excellent group. And so, you know, the original commission for public broadcasting, what is now being reinvented as the Corporation for Republican Broadcasting, and the original commission for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was to serve underserved markets, to make available programming in areas where there is a need, but the commercial marketplace isn't adequate to fill that need. You find that in broadcasting, you find that in the arts, you find that in basic sciences. There are a whole lot of different areas where the marketplace isn't the solution to everything. The marketplace does a lot, sure, but it's not the solution to everything. Anyhow, back to the Family Research Council. They support the overturn of Roe v. Wade. Well, surprise, surprise. I remember when I was in high school many years ago, it was against the law to have an abortion. And there was a woman in my school, a girl in my school, I guess you could, and she was, I don't know, 16, 17. This was in high school. I didn't know her. I mean, I knew her. I recognized her in the cafeteria kind of thing. I was not part of her social crowd or whatever you would call that, so I can't say that I knew her well. I knew who she was. She got pregnant, she had an illegal abortion, and she died. That's, you know, they want to take us back to those days. The Family Research Council is against workers' rights, against freedom of choice for abortion, and against gay rights. The Family Research Council claims its goal is to promote, quote, the traditional family unit of the Judeo-Christian value system upon which it is built. Now, here's what really baffles me. The Family Research Council says that they are in favor of the Judeo-Christian value system. Now, I've read the Bible actually 4 times. I don't sleep very easily. I'm just one of those light sleepers. So I read at night before I go to sleep. And you can get these great things. They're called Through the Bible in a Year. And every night you read like for about 20 minutes. And at the end of a year, you've read the whole Bible. And it's you know, for 4 different years, I've used that as my nighttime reading. And yeah, I was fascinated. I was curious about it. I read a couple of different translations. I read the King James once. I read the New International Version once, the New American Version once, and one of the more obscure ones. And in any case, my recollection is that Paul, in the New Testament, said that a bishop of the church should be of good character and preferably have only one wife. But he wasn't speaking of everybody. And in fact, Solomon had 700 wives. David had a bunch of wives. I mean, the Mormons are actually right about this. I'm talking about the Joseph Smith Mormons, the real Mormons. If you want true Judeo-Christian families, you've got one father, a bunch of mothers, a bunch of kids, and there you go. Polygamy. That's what the Bible promotes. So why aren't these guys out there supporting polygamy? I don't get it. Why don't they have some? If they're absolutely in favor of Judeo-Christian values, why aren't they promoting polygamy? Because monogamy has been a relatively recent thing. It's a cultural thing. It's post-biblical. With the exception, as I said, of Paul saying that if you're going to be a bishop in the church, you should have one wife. Anyhow, they want to turn back the clock, but they don't really want to turn back the clock. They just want to pretend that they want to turn back the clock. The Family Research Council has said same-sex marriage threatens... And by the way, if they're absolutely so, you know, gung-ho about these things, you know, let's go back to the old ways. What about, you know, in Deuteronomy, where it says that you can't wear clothing made out of more than two fabrics? Is it Deuteronomy or Leviticus? One of the... It's probably in both. Or where it says that in order to declare that you are divorced from a woman, you take her shoes outside the house. Or that if somebody works on the Sabbath, that they should be stoned to death by the community. And we're not talking about with pot. Or that somebody should be put to death if they eat shellfish. Oh, well, you know, when Jesus came, all those old rules got changed. There's this new covenant. Well, I don't recall Jesus talking about having only one wife, and so we're back to that again. Anyhow, as I said, you know, Joseph Smith had a point. Not that I agree with it, but if you want to be biblical, he had a point. The Family Research Council said same-sex marriage threatens religious freedom and that AIDS awareness promotes homosexuality, if you can believe it. Being less bigoted. In their mind, you know, the end of bigotry in the United States is going to somehow destroy religious freedom. This is the same argument that was made in the 1960s against repealing laws, miscegenation. Anyhow, the laws of against people of opposite races or different races marrying that were only repealed in the 1960s. You look at some of these folks, you know, the Family Research Council, Tony Perkins. In 2001, Perkins addressed the Louisiana chapter of the Council of Concerned Citizens, America's premier white supremacist organization, the successor to the White Citizens Council, which battled integration in the South. In 1996, Perkins paid former Ku Klux Klan Grand Wizard David Duke $82,500 for his mailing list. Now we're starting to figure out what's the agenda. Why are these guys so opposed to abortion? When you drill down a little deeper and you really talk to these guys, and I've actually engaged in conversation with some of these folks, some of these real hard right, you know, quote, Christian, end quote, cranks, they will tell you that their concern, the reason why they're opposed to abortion is because they're concerned that white people are having abortions. And they want to make sure that, you know, whites are always a majority, and it gets back to racism. Tony Perkins also issued a veiled threat to sitting judges. He said, and I quote, "There's more than one way to skin a cat, and there's more than one way to take the black robe off the bench," end quote. Oh, really? This was at the time that judges' families were being murdered. James Dobson, FRC founder and Focus on the Family leader, he compares Roe v. Wade to the Holocaust and compares the Supreme Court to the Ku Klux Klan. Bishop Harry Jackson with Hope Christian Church in College Park, Maryland. He's Justice Sunday's only black speaker. He's recently unveiled his black contract with America. He says, black churches are too concerned with justice. Too concerned with justice. William Donahue with the Catholic League. He says, Democratic senators opposed to Bush judicial nominations are anti-Catholic. Justice Sunday featured a token Catholic, William Donahue, who heads a group that refers to themselves as the nation's largest Catholic civil rights organization, the Catholic League. Far from it, sorry. Strange things coming, my friends. Strange things. 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
When sundown pales the sky, I want to hide a while behind your smile. And everywhere I look, your eyes are fine.
And thank you for kindly, Bob, there. And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 5 minutes before the hour. Okay, I have got the smartest listeners in the world, and many of them are in our chat room. And one of them, informed and reborn in our chat room, points out to me that I'd have to find the chapter and verse. I think it was in Matthew there someplace. Matthew 5. No, that's about divorce. That in Matthew, what was it? Matthew 17, wasn't it? Anyhow, Jesus says, you know, for this reason a man leaves his mother and father and cleaves to his wife, and they two become one flesh. And so that seems to imply that the New Testament is about monogamy. Okay, I'll give you that. I still don't find the bigotry and the overlay of white power and the anti-gay attitude and the anti-woman attitudes, which you can certainly find, the anti-woman attitudes in Paul. I mean, go back and read in Romans where he talks about, I believe it's in Romans, where he talks about, you know, the role of women in the church, that they should shut up, they should sit in the back, their heads should be covered, these kinds of things. I just don't think that this is appropriate, frankly. This is, who's going to argue religion? Anyhow, Justice Sunday, the point of all this is whether it's not about what, you know, my opinion on it is, or even your opinion or anybody else's opinion. The point is, should somebody's religious opinion, should their interpretation of the Bible be part of our laws, part of our civic laws? Because we live in a secular nation, a secular society, meaning a society in which the law is the law. It's not, you know, it's not like God's law in charge of us. It's our law. Us decide. You know, the Ten Commandments, there's only two of the Ten Commandments that are actually part of our law. Don't steal and don't kill. We don't put people to death for not respecting their parents or not following the Sabbath or worshiping a God other than the one God. So, you know, that's really what it boils down to. And these guys want to impose theocracy in America. So that said, finally, I want to just wrap up with Cindy Sheehan responding. Well, actually, we're out of time. I just want to salute Cindy Sheehan for the great work that she is doing, standing up to Bill O'Reilly and to that dreadful Michelle Malkin, who said, was talking about Casey, Cindy's son, and saying, you know, he wouldn't want his mom doing that. And Cindy saying, hey, you know, I'm the one who nursed him, who raised him, who nurtured him, and I know what he wanted. She says, I don't recall Michelle Malkin ever talking with him. Boy, spot on. Cindy Sheehan, you stand up to him. You go, girl. Really. This is such an extraordinary moment in our time. Please keep the blogs going, keep the calls going, keep the issue going. Keep Cindy out there and support her in your prayers, your thoughts, your good vibes, sending her light, whatever it takes, and whatever's right for you. We'll see you again tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.